Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. This show, the Guardians of the Holy Grail, was created by me to clear up many of the popular misconceptions that have been perpetrated in the mainstream media regarding the secret societies, Holy Grail mysteries, and the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Through this show, I hope to set the record straight, so to speak, with some hard facts with authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Initiatic Societies. I, myself, am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar that over the centuries has either been lost or ignored. You can learn more about our Gnostic Temple organization, and you can sign our mailing list and receive our monthly e-news by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplar.org. You can also sign up while you're there for the 18 Lesson Gnostic Templar e-course, become an associate member. There's videos to watch, books to buy. There's also my recent book, or recently published book, called The World Gnosis, The Coming Gnostic Civilization, wherein I chronologue the movement that has passed down through the Knights Templar and the secret societies to found a one-world civilization that's based on Gnostic spirituality. This movement to a one-world civilization actually began thousands of years ago, before the Knights Templar even formed on the legendary motherlands of Atlantis and Lemuria, and that is exactly where this book begins. The book ends with a description of what this new Gnostic civilization will possibly look like, and the new spirituality that will be a part of it. You can order this book through the web store on our website, there again at www.gnostictemplars.org. Now, today, if you have any questions for our guests, feel free to call our toll-free number, which is 866-472-5795. Now, before we get to today's guests, I'd like to briefly mention the tour that I'm leading in September 20th to the 30th, in the Languedoc region of southern France and also northern Spain, with my friend and high priestess of the Mary Magdalene Mysteries, Nancy Safford. We're planning this tour around the equinox and the full moon time because we want to do a lot of ceremony and ritual to really connect with a lot of the mysteries that are being revealed in the Languedoc region right now. And we're going to have featured on our tour a couple speakers, Ben Hammett and Henry Lincoln, that live down in that area. They're going to talk specifically about the most recent discoveries that have been made. As some of you might know, there was a cave discovered by Ben Hammett that contained a mummy that he thinks could be the mummy of Mary Magdalene. And right now, I guess he's hot on the trail of an underground Solomon's temple that he believed was built there at least 1,000 years ago, I guess. But as many of you know, the Languedoc is the land of the goddess and her mysteries, and we believe that these mysteries are really coming to light now in the goddess as part of the goddess revival around the planet. So we'll be going to Rennes-le-Château, Montségur, Montserrat in northern Spain, also Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, where Mary Magdalene and some of the other Marys, who were disciples of Jesus, landed after leaving the Holy Land. So we're going to cover a lot of territory and really get involved with the whole goddess Gnostic tradition. We have three places left, and that's it. Once they're taken, the tour is full. So if you're interested in one of those places, you might want to go to this website right away and register. It's www.sacredsitesjourneys.com. Sacredsitesjourneys.com. So for today's show, we have a very special guest. We have Prince Nicholas de Vere von Drakenberg, who's the Sovereign Grand Master of the Imperial and Royal Dragon Court and Order. As many of you might know, the Imperial and Royal Dragon Court was revived in the 15th century by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, but its roots go back, virtually to the dawn of history as an order that has been producing dragon kings and queens who possess special dragon blood and genes that give them special abilities. Prince Nicholas is a member of the House of De Vere, which has produced many of the dragon kings and queens throughout history, and has also been a guardian of the Holy Grail tradition. Prince Nicholas has written about the ancient dragon court and his special De Vere lineage in his two published books, The Dragon Legacy, and his newly published The Dragon Seed. They're both great books and a lot of great information. So greetings, Nick, and welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Oh, good evening, Cousin Mark. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thank you for being on. We've got a lot of questions, and I personally have a lot of questions, having recently joined your Dragon Corps.
Yeah.
So, first of all, can you just, briefly and succinctly, if you can explain, what exactly is the Dragon Corps?
The Dragon Corps is what I would consider to be the cultural and physical manifestation of the dragon spirit within the blood of the ancient kings. So today we operate as an archive, research facility, and an outreach and support for people both with the dragon blood and people of all faiths, races and philosophies. And as you know, being a member, we have a lot of people in sovereignty from various different faiths and disciplines. And one of the main purposes of the Dragon Corps today is to foster and encourage tolerance, love, support, and friendship amongst peoples.
Well, Nick, you have a Facebook page, and you started a new one today. Are these Facebook pages that you would recommend that people can visit to know more about what you're doing?
Certainly, yes. Dragon Sovereignty on Facebook. And a new one started today, slightly more, well, a lot more serious. The Dragon Sovereignty page is meant to be informative and fun, whereas the new Facebook group, the Convivienza of Toledo, is hoping to restore the spirit of cooperation and tolerance amongst those not only of the Abrahamic faith, but also all faiths worldwide. And so it's intended to be, again, a support and discussion group for people who are committed to peace.
Excellent, excellent. Do you currently have a website that you can also advise people to visit at this time?
Well, our mutual cousin, Charles Johnson, is compiling one this week. And that should be us and on the net in a couple of weeks. It'll be in baby form, if you like, to begin with, and we'll build it up as the months go on.
Excellent, excellent. Do you know what the website address is going to be?
haven't really decided entirely yet. I'm going to discuss that with Charles either tonight or tomorrow, and I'll post it up on our Dragon Sovereignty website for you, Facebook page, sorry.
Okay, great. Well, I can see you're doing a lot with the Dragon Court right now, and you're certainly getting the information about it out into the world. Is there some special reason why you've chosen this time now to spread the wisdom about the Dragon Court?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that the roots of the idea started about 10, 16 years ago. And I just simply thought it was necessary because there has been, I suppose, so much misinformation about the Grail and the role of Jesus and the Grail blood knocking around. All it seems to be carved into stone. And I just wanted to give a different perspective and back it up with not only biochemical endocrinal information, but also with genetic information as well, which you've obviously read in the Dragon Seed, Mark.
Exactly right. I'll be asking you about that in a minute. How many members do you currently have in the Dragon Court?
Last time I looked, I think it was a couple of hundred. The Dragon Court today, the main family court, which obviously you're a member of, is for relatives by genetics or genealogy. And so we're having new cousins turn up all the time. One, which you'll have seen on the Dragon Sovereignty Facebook page, is Nikki Kropacek, who is the senior representative of the House of Draculescu Basarab. And we are very, very pleased to welcome him on board, and he and I will be exchanging letters and honours sometime this week, and making the amalgamation of the families official. But yes, about 200 members, I would say. But yes, it is growing, and especially the companionate, which is the open court for probationers, spouses, friends, and supporters who aren't necessarily related by blood. So, you know, we're a broad church, and we welcome anyone who values the truth, honor, nobility, and wants to make some kind of change in the world.
So, anybody who wants to join, do they need to be connected as I am to you through genealogy, or is that primarily the prerequisite to becoming a member?
Well, the promise I made to the family was that it would, the actual family court, you know, the main court, would be cousins related by genetics or genealogy. And it was originally simply for the Veers. But we've expanded quite a lot. But as you know, you have Veer and Bruce Blood. There are lots of individuals coming on board who are actually descended from the Veers, but don't actually have the Veer name. And so we have expanded and broadened our welcome, so to speak. But the companionate, who are just as valuable, they don't have to be related at all.
So the way I understand it is one reason that you are elitist, so to speak, is that you, from ancient times, the dragons have wanted to keep the dragon lineage, the dragon blood, pure, and this is why they intermarried and And this is why the dragon court was limited to relatives. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. There is no sense of social snobbery or elitism about it. During the ancient times, it was considered that dragon princesses, princes, queens, and kings were gifted with certain abilities, which were transferred through the genes, the blood. You know, to quote the Bible, you know, the spirit, the life is in the blood, or the spirit is in the blood. This is very much so with dragons. And so they tended to intermarry between themselves to make sure that the abilities they had were maintained at as high a level as possible. And we find this especially during the Scythian Druidic period, where the Druids would choose the Athelings to intermarry, you know, because the primary function of, say, a Dragon King, the clue is in the title. A king is in Saxon, the word comes from Saxon, and the actual word is kenning, and kenning, as you know, means knowledge or wisdom. So these people were supposed to be pontiffs or intermediaries in a kind of a hermetic way between the other world and this world, and they were supposed to be able to make practical predictions about environment, climate, and various other matters, you know, the outcomes of wars, the best alliances to make, and so on. So it was absolutely vital that they maintained these abilities. And if you look at the Gothic word for king, it's Cunninyam, and that means the son of the noble race, which connects it principally to the Scythio-Aryans. But as I pointed out, the actual word noble comes from the Greek, which is related to gnosis, again, wisdom or knowing. So in Gothic and in Saxon, the two are virtually identical.
Well, you in your book, Nick, you trace back this line of dragon kings and queens to the Anunnaki. What is your take on the Anunnaki? Who were they? Where did they come from? And did they come here specifically to establish lineages of dragon kings and queens?
The Anunnaki have one principal gene that we know of surviving today, apart from odd, strange genes my family have. But the one principal gene that recognizes them as humanoid and as being the firstborn, if you wish, is the melanocortin-1 receptor gene on chromosome 16q23.4, I believe it is. I haven't got the notes in front of me. This gene is 350,000 years older than the genome of Homo sapiens sapiens. So it was introduced into the Homo sapien genome by this legendary hybridization. Some people say cloning. That has too many negative connotations for me, but we can say they intermarried or interbred with the people who were once called the Eljo and created Homo sapiens sapiens from your basic Homo sapien race. The genes, you'll find it mentioned in the work of Ben Sira. Lilith is called the Red-Haired Queen of the North. You'll find it's related to Minos and Rhadamanthus and Zeus. Most of the gods had red hair, it would appear, even down to Jesus. Going thousands and thousands of years later, his description in Roman records clearly states that he was red-haired. And so it seems to be quite a significant gene within dragon royalty.
So this is obviously one of the characteristics that one inherits through that gene. What are some of the other characteristics or abilities that one could receive through that gene?
Foreknowledge, prophecy, the ability to create magic without dancing around a cat naked, if you don't mind me joking. It's all done in the head. I think also heightened awareness of one's own future and destiny. And certainly it would appear a kind of a spiritual protection. You know, if you fall in it, you seem to come out smelling of roses. And sometimes we fall in it quite often. But things always work themselves out. The other main quality is the ability to quieten the mind, to transcend, and to unite with the Akasha and with life itself, with the universe, where there is no division between you and it. There is just it, you know. So these, I think, are the main qualities that immediately spring to mind, Mark.
Well, I think I remember you encourage members of the Dragon Court to have their DNA read to see if they carry that particular gene, right?
Yeah. There are several types. There's the R1B haplogroup that descends directly from the House of Hamelech in Israel, which is David and Solomon's bunch. And Jesus' lot. And that goes all the way back to Prince Aram, who married Princess Kirtasharit, who was a descendant of Akhenaten. And as we've posted on the Dragon Sovereignty, the Egyptian pharaohs were actually Europeans, inverted commas. So...
Well, I'm also curious about the dragon blood that flows through the veins of members of the dragon lineage. It also has special qualities, does it not?
So the dragon blood?
Yeah.
Yes. Traditionally, it contained high quantities of melatonin, tryptophan, telomerase, and numerous other neurotransmitters and hormones, which have particular effects on the way that the brain works.
Mm-hmm. And in the ancient dragon courts, was it common to during rituals to actually be passing this blood around members of the court and having them consume this blood?
Yeah.
And there were special rites that were done with females, right? To catch what you call the star fire. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. There's it's not a ritual so much as what you might call a psychosomatic exercise. In order to produce more of these chemicals, the girls would, and the males would, what we call now, open up or enliven the chakras, or the sephira. And these are aligned to the main hormone-excreting glands in the body, And once these are psychosomatically woken up, if you like, or enlivened, the Krebs cycle is also increased, then you get an increase of these chemicals. So it's not so much a ritual as it is an exercise.
Is there anything, any ritual like this that, you're still performing in the Dragon Court today? Where you're actually drinking the blood or receiving the blood of each other or whatever?
Actually, Mark, that's a question I think he's answered in the Dragon's Feed. And I can't speak for individuals. We're scattered across the planet. And if I may jokingly say, who knows what they get up to on a Sunday afternoon when it's raining, there's nothing on telly. So I can't answer that. For me personally, yes.
If members of the court aren't consuming the dragon's blood, is there any kind of other elixir that you would recommend for them to kind of have a similar effect on them?
Yes. Though far less far less powerful. You can go onto the internet and you can buy tryptophan, telomerase, melatonin, serotonin, all these neurotransmitters and hormones. So although it's not live, so to speak, and not enlivened, I would say that it's an adequate replacement.
Well, you also mentioned, I think, in one of your books that unless a person has the dragon blood, they're not going to respond so strongly to these kind of more common elixirs. Isn't that right?
Yeah. There is a way in which we are, if you like, wired a little uniquely. And I'm going to be doing some research and a paper with one of our court physicians within the next 6 months or so. And we're hoping to publish a detailed schematic later on next year.
Excellent. Well, you're certainly doing a lot of work these days. Another question I have there's all conspiratists can make a conspiracy about anything, and of course they have about the Anunnaki as a race that came here and has been trying to control the planet ever since. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Anunnaki intended that their descendants in this lineage of the Dragon Kings and Queens would perpetually rule over the planet? Was that the plan?
No, it wasn't. Let's be frank about this. The younger Anunnaki were bone idle, and they got sick to death of doing all the work, and so they complained like hell to Mum and Dad, and said, can't we get somebody else to do it? And the guys that were around at the time really didn't quite understand what was required of them. So that's when the Anunnaki decided to inject a bit of their own blood into Homo sapiens in order to have them not only as human kings, but also as servants and supporters and so on. I wouldn't have thought for one moment that the Anunnaki even considered the idea of world domination. And quite frankly, I don't today. And there are all sorts of modern conspiracies, you know, about the dragons and the Anunnaki and everything. And really, quite frankly, I can't take any of them seriously. It's almost, what can you say, a knee-jerk reaction arising from, you know, victim mentality, as far as I'm concerned, is a sense of loneliness, disenfranchisement, and so on. And as the more society breaks down, the more fear there is that there are conspiracies for new world order or the Illuminati or whatever to jump in and take over. And quite frankly, I'd have personally nothing to do with that. I think it's nonsense. And I'm not part of any conspiracy at all. I'm considered to be, I think it was the University of Heidelberg, as you know, published a thing called the World Government Schematic. And it was posted up by Jeremy Dahl, who is a leading social libertarian in Tennessee, I believe. There's Drakenberg on the bottom left-hand corner. And I haven't really got a clue why, but there you go. So, conspiracies, not into them. And the Anunnaki, no, not world domination, just bone idol.
Well, would you say
you
that
can
those
read that in Sumerian, annals of history?
Well, would you say that those with dragon blood are more suited to rule? And is there any kind of movement to put those in the dragon lineage back on the thrones of the world?
No. Catholic Church has been trying to keep them off for the last 1,500 years. Done a pretty good job of it as well. I have no support for anybody who wants to go and jump on someone's throne. Because if you are transcendent, then the concept of hubris or ambition is a bit redundant, especially for me. I really, really don't care. You know, life is good, and I really don't want to have to mix with people that I wouldn't give house room to, and I just don't want the hassle. And any sensible dragon would say exactly the same thing. I'm doing what kings have been doing, proper priest kings have been doing for a long, long time. And we go back to the concept of kingship as knowing, and of the concept of intercession, of pontiffship, and so on. The original purpose and role of a king was as a guide to souls and a guide to the living. And if any dragons take up any position of responsibility, it should be as wise counselors as much as they are able, not tyrants and despots. I totally oppose any form of power grabbing. We've had all that for hundreds and hundreds of years, and I think it's about time that the planet came to its senses and ego and hubris was gently removed from politics. Because it's not going to work. The Dragon Court itself is almost like a hive, I suppose. It's an egalitarian collective. Yes, it's an imperial and royal court, but within the Dragon Court, whether you're a companion or a full member or whatever, everyone's first name terms, everyone's considered social equals. And so, you know, it would never occur to me to personally wish to take over anyone's throne. I already have an acknowledged princedom, which is registered with the Home Office in Britain. So, you know, no point.
Well, what would you say about the future? What form of government do you think that we're moving towards? Do you have any opinion on that?
Not a fixed and firm opinion, no. I mean, if you go onto Sky TV and check out edgemediatv.com, they have a lot of theories about the New World Order and slow progression towards totalitarianism. And it seems to the proponents of this knowledge that it is inexorable and unstoppable. I would say don't take for granted the will of the people, because if anyone gets up to any of the nonsense that these conspiracies are promoting, I think you're going to have a massive backlash. Personally, I'm a bit of a pessimist. I think things are going to get a lot worse before they get better.
Well, I wouldn't call myself a monarchist, but if you look back in history...
No, nor am I.
theocracy seems to be the form of government that has survived the longest by far.
Yeah. I agree with you. And if there was some sane theocracy which wasn't based on blind dogma, belief and tying the party line, I'd be all for it. If it's based on Gnosis, as the Gnostic Templars support and propose, and as you know, as a member of your group as well, I would go all out for it.
Well, I'm curious about the House of De Vere. How and when did that actually get linked to the Dragon Court, the Dragon lineage? How far back can you take the House of De Vere?
The first king there raised his nose above the parapet in 400 BC. He was an elven or fairy king of what is now Scotland, used to be Pictavia. And he passed the Vere name, or title, should I say, down through, I think it's about 1,000 years, until the establishment of the Dragon Court in Europe by Melusine Vere, who was the wife of Ranfroy de Vere. And that's when the first Dragon Court in Europe started. Several centuries later, King Sigismund's family, the Luxembourg family, changed their lineage fraudulently in order to be able to claim descent from this dragon princess. And it appears to me that in so doing, they gave some kind of legitimacy to the Societas Draconis, which Sigismund founded. Several dates of the for the inception of Societas Draconis, or the Dragon Court, have been put forward. The earliest was by an old friend of mine from the Warburg Institute, and he claims that it was first conceived of by Sigismund in 1397 and formulated and then opened to the public in 1408. Sigismund at the time was invited to St. George's Chapel, Windsor, where he was made a Knight of the Garter at the same time as my ancestor, Richard, the 11th Earl of Oxford. And at that time, Richard was also, according to the traditional practice of exchanging honours, Richard was made a baron and a member of the Dragon Court. And as I said, it's from the very earliest time, all Dragon Courts, starting with the Anunnaki, going through Shebek Nefru, the right to them and the spirit of them has been carried in the blood royal. And as a senior, as the senior head of the House of Vere, as a descendant of the House of Luxembourg and so on, the right falls to me to be head of the Dragon Court in the 21st century.
Well, I guess the members, some of the members of the House of Anjou, or especially the Plantagenets who evolved from them, Richard the First, especially, I remember him saying that well, the Plantagenets, they came from the devil, and of course a lot of people thought, well, you know, you can say that because they fight a lot, but apparently, having read your books, you can actually take what he says rather literally, that it does go back to an energy, a conscious of being that has been for some time associated with the devil or Satan, right?
The Plantagenets are a junior branch of the House of Vere. They're what you would call a cadet branch. They're a cadet branch because they descend from Princess Melusine's younger sister. The name Plantagenet doesn't derive from the practice of Geoffrey of Anjou wearing a broom sprig or Plantagenista in his cap. The name Plantagenet comes from Princess Plantina, mother of the family. A junior Vere married, I think it was Ida of Ardennes, and Ida of Ardennes had Ida de Vere, who then married into the Plantagenets, the early Angevins, and so they do have the Vere blood, but it's a junior line, and that is why they are a cadet branch. Now, Melusine was called the daughter of Satan, and actually her line does devolve back through Brood MacMile to King Vere, and then from King Vere we have associations and connections through the Irish Tuadanu, often mispronounced Tuatha De Danann, and these were Scythians from Western Central Scythia. They were involved in the Greek Wars at one point, and the Sarmatians kicked them out, and they moved to Ireland. Before that, they were descended from the Mitanni, who were Scythians who were living in Assyria, and the Mitanni axe lords were married into the Pharaonic line. And the Pharaonic line goes back to Raneb, and although the Bible says that Cain was the son of Adam, he wasn't. He was actually the ancestor of Raneb, and he was the son of Enki, who the Jews based Satan on. You know, the war in heaven and all this. Now, Satan wasn't an inferior angel. He was the half-brother of El, who then became Jehovah. So, some of it's been mixed up and altered for political reasons anciently. But yes, if we change the name Satan back to Ea or Enki, then yes, you have that descent in our lineage and in Melusine's lineage and in the lineage of the Plantagenets.
I guess you can tie that in with the Anunnaki by saying that Enki was the leader of the Anunnaki, right?
He was by right, but some accounts say that El, or Enlil, to give him his proper name, killed his father, Anu, and wrested the throne and the crown from Enki, who was the son of the eldest queen, and by rights, the leader of the Anunnaki. And that's where you get this war in heaven notion from, which is replicated, I think, in Hindu doctrine, and you find it also as the war of the Olympians against the Titans being the elder gods, and the Olympians under Zeus, who is a form of Enlil. So you get it replicated all over the place, really.
Well, apparently you get it through Jesus. In your book, The Dragon Seed, you're actually able to trace Jesus' lineage back to Enki, and that's certainly going to be a major revelation for a lot of people, that Jesus was descended from that being known as the devil. Would you like to comment on that?
It's accurate, genetically and genealogically. So it's not a Teddy's bedtime story. But I do realize that in actually publishing this, there is a little bit of mischievousness on my part, because I know there's going to be a lot of doctrinal bigots and fundamentalists out there who are going to go ballistic. And if they do, then it's a good day's work done as far as I'm concerned. Because, as far as I'm concerned, doctrinal bigotry killed thousands of people during the witch trials, and it's killed thousands of Jews, it's killed thousands of Christians, whatever, you know, whichever side you look at. So, genetically, Jesus had the red gene, the melanocortin gene. That's an Anunnaki gene. And I get it through him, whether people like it or not. It has been more or less proved archaeologically that Jesus was married. And there are several references to intimacy, I think, in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and the Gospel of Philip and so on. And the R1B gene that I have, and all us lot have, descends from him and from his ancestors, David and Solomon and Rama and the pharaohs and so on.
Well, I think you probably know that I'm completely in agreement with you, and I've written similarly in my books. It's just a matter of being able to translate that to people that don't have our understanding and have them accept it. Not easy.
Well, I don't know. You see, hold on. I'm not in the business of either making money or trying to win friends and influence people. If I did try either, there would be an adequate suspicion that I was a fraud and a con artist, and that I was making this rubbish up simply to sell books. I don't. Number one, all the royalties paid for the Dragon Legacy and the Dragon Seed are paid to Mike Hunter, who's our Dragon King of Arms, and he pays that annually to various ecological and social welfare charities. So I'm not making a red cent out of it. The whole lot goes to charity. Number two, if you're trying to win friends and influence people, not my bag, because if you are, then you have to compromise the truth as you see it, and you have to alter the directness of your approach simply to make others happy. And I'm an iconoclast. You know, I'm not a brown nose. People either accept it or they don't. And it's probably up to people far greater and more intelligent than me to convince the public of the veracity and validity of those statements. I've presented the genetic and the genealogical information, and as far as I'm concerned, Mark, people can do with it what they wish. If it makes some kind of a social difference, or it makes people think twice about Pauline dogma and the nonsense of early Catholicism, which has influenced every denomination in the world, then, and it makes people less dogmatic, less rigid, and more open to meditating and thinking upon things before, you know, blowing up another sacred cow with a bicycle pump, then that's got to be a good thing, don't you think?
Well, since we've we're already treading the land of controversy, my next question is about well, vampires. We know that one of the members of Sigismund's court was Vlad III, also known as Dracula, and of course, in your books, you've got a whole different definition of what a vampire is. Can you explain that?
Hold on. Now, the word vampire comes from an ancient Anatolian word, uber. And the word uber means witch. Now, in Scythian, which is a language closely related to Anatolia, the later word for a witch was druid. And the role of a druid was as a kingmaker and a priest-king, a healer, and a keeper of records and so on and so on, a brief, as they were later called. So a vampire, or witch, is basically a druid and a seer. And the more violent vampiric connotations that are now associated, or were formerly associated with vampires by our dear friends in Hollywood, actually came from the Scythian oblique fairy, oblique elf practice of drinking the blood of the fallen in battle, whereas the proper vampiric rites were starfire, which we've discussed earlier. Now, the word uber or vampire is translated very much consistently into Russian and into German, and both very strongly suggest a link with the word uber or over. And given their role, you might say that the original vampires were high kings and queens, princes and princesses and so on. And the recent nonsense that Hollywood put forward over the last 50 years or so, which is now kind of dying out with films like, what's it, what's that thing with Kristen Stewart in, Mark? I can't remember. Twilight, that's it. You know, the more romantic view of vampire. So, in summary, vampires aren't just lifeless souls, bodies inhabited by demons who go around thinking totally and only of drinking blood. They actually had a social role to perform for their people as both a servant, a protector, and a representative. And there are old Romanian tales, very early vampire tales, where the vampires and their charges, their human charges, got on, you know, like a house on fire. And one of the main duties of the vampires and the vampire kings was the protection of the people. And somehow or another, down the line, and I can bet your bottom dollar it was the Vatican who first instigated it, their reputation has hit the skids. Increasingly, as the Roman Church has gained more and more power from AD 400 on, they've tried to wipe out any form of opposition to their hegemony and their profit margin. And these vampire dragon kings and queens were just simply standing in the way, which is why I believe the Merovingians were ousted in favor of the more compliant Carolingians. It's all been a very, very long conspiracy by the church to blacken the dragon name and to put themselves on top. And as you've probably read in both the Legacy and in the Seed, we have a document that the Vatican knocked up called the Donation of Constantine, and that was purportedly written by Constantine to Pope Sylvester. And Constantine was supposed to have been so grateful to the Pope for curing his leprosy that Constantine gave the entire Roman Empire over to this said Pope Sylvester, and it was signed in 329 just before his death. Big problem. Donation of Constantine was written in Vulgate Latin, which is the Latin St. Jerome used in the Vulgate Bible, and this Latin first came into popular use in AD 700 and something. The document was actually forged by a scribe working in Paris in around about 947 AD, I believe it was. And it began to be used by the Pope towards the beginning of the middle medieval period, and he was waving it under everybody's nose and demanding that everyone bent the knee. And he also demanded that the only people that could crown kings were the Catholic Church. And the whole thing was a load of bunk. It's a complete lie. It's a forgery. And it's one of the main reasons we haven't had any valid kings or queens in Europe since the time of Charlemagne. And therefore, we haven't got any valid government institutions. None of the people that purportedly are Christian monarchs who sit on thrones today or are Christian princes have any fons honorum. Therefore, for the last 15 or so hundred years, all the titles and honors and all the coats of arms that these Christians have dished out have been completely fraudulent and worthless.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you.
Sorry about that.
Oh, thank you for
trying
that,
to show you
that
how
long explanation.
Vampires went into decline.
A lot of great information. But we do have a caller on line one. He's calling himself Brother M, and he has, I believe has a question for you.
Okay, fire away.
Brother Hello. M, are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Brother M. You've got a question for
yes.
Nicholas?
Yes, I do. In fact, I have two. I'm sorry for keeping anonymity. It's not for myself, but for the lady that I'm going to bring up. I know a lady for several years now who has very vivid, she's of the dragon bloodline, without a mm-hmm. doubt. She has very vivid memories at times of past incarnations.
Yep.
And one of these visions that she's shared with me is that she remembers a time when she seems to have been in the role of a Grail maiden,
uh-huh.
very much like you discuss in your
yeah.
books. And I wanted to see if you could provide some sort of confirmation, because she shared some details with me that I have never come across before. And for instance, she remembers being, this was a time that wasn't very ancient. I imagine somewhere between 17th and 18th or 19th, 17th and 18th centuries.
Yeah.
There were no cars, but there were horse-drawn carriages. There was a church. She was involved in going to this church on a regular basis, and a priest or some figure that was very priest-like was her companion, who helped her to provide the fluids to others that she never met,
mm-hmm.
who waited, and she never met them. Now,
mm-hmm.
She remembers entering this, and she traveled. This wasn't only happening in one place. This was happening in different places, and she remembered something in common with each of these places that she would go. Each of these chapels would have a small door on the left side of the altar. That would be the place where she would go.
Mm-hmm.
And then this ritual or this exercise would take place. I appreciate very much the way you call it a psychosomatic exercise. I believe
yes,
that
it is, yeah.
That's exactly what she had. She has memories of having been trained in that, and certain hermetic things that I've stumbled across by accident in reading to her have triggered this.
Yeah.
With her.
Mm-hmm.
Does this bring up anything that you would give a confirmation on?
Reincarnation. I'm a bit iffy about reincarnation because it's been, it's almost a kind of an Eastern heaven and hell carrot and stick situation. You know, you be good and you won't come back as an earthworm or something. So I'm
well. Rather than
reincarnation, I think it's a bit more direct. If you have dragon blood, then you're far more likely to have genetic and racial memory, and you're far more likely to remember past incarnations of yourself as an earlier member of your family. So, yes, reincarnation, I'm all for it, but I just think it needs qualifying. And what I would say to her is that if she has dragon blood, then it's almost 99.9% likely that what she's seeing is absolutely true.
Thank you. Now, the second question has to do with my studies with a certain French adept and alchemist. He taught us that within the blood of highly evolved adepts can be found the same kind of fire that the alchemists seek to concentrate in vegetable and mineral work, and that it can be tested, it can be verified. He taught, for instance, that the reason why the Grail cup came to be so significant was that it was the blood that held the cup that held the blood of Christ, that the blood was the important thing, not the cup. It seems to be very similar to the DNA being like a cup and holding the fire within, but there again, it may be that while the DNA is important, it's that secret fire that is also...
It's the fire within the blood, or DNA, that is important. You're absolutely right.
Now, he taught about being able to test this by taking blood and simply putting it into a test tube with a bit of mercury, metal mercury, and it would, if there was a high level of transmutative power to the blood, it would transmute a certain number of atoms in a layer on that test tube glass that would coat the glass with a colored layer that you could then hold up to the light and analyze in various ways to find out how much of that mercury had been transmuted. And that an adept that had reached the level of Tifereth would transmute completely the entire content of the test tube. Of course, this would have to be done very carefully because the mercury needs to be brought to a fuming state, so it would have to be done outdoors, and it's dangerous and toxic and everything else.
Yes.
Have you run across any kind of teaching like this? Because it seems so accessible to people to be able to do as a test.
I must admit that this one's new on me. Although I've studied certain aspects of alchemy, I think your French master must be a fascinating character. To have either discovered or developed such a concept. And it certainly hasn't come to my attention before.
And I must thank you very much for telling me about it.
You're very welcome.
Now, yeah, if they go outside, put a helmet on, some visors, and some chainmail, why not do the test? See if it does work. Be brilliant.
Well, thank you, Brother Ram.
Train an ape to do it. I'm just joking. No, but I've never heard of it. It's absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Ram. And thank you for that last question, because it leads me to one other question I'd like to ask Nick, which is that, as a Knight Templar, of course, any information related to the Holy Grail is very important to me. And I've been hearing for some time that the House of Anjou, and therefore the House of De Vere, has been connected to the Holy Grail tradition. In Parzival, for example, Wolfram von Aschenbach talks about how Parzival and the Grail family were from the House of Anjou. Now, so I'm wondering if the Holy Grail that was guarded by the House of Anjou or the House of Vere, was that the sacred blood, the sacred dragon blood?
Yes. Yeah, that's what the Serpent Rouge is, if you think about it, or the underground stream. It's that continuity of the bloodline going down through millennia.
I see. Okay. Well, I just have one or two more questions. I'm sure people are going to wonder, if they were to become a member of the Dragon Court, what happens then? Is there some special study? Is there rites or disciplines? Or is there anything that they would be involved in at that point?
Because it is my contention that what people call magic is a perfectly integral and natural part of the dragon experience. I kind of have this notion that certain rituals and ceremonies and so on aren't necessary. If you're having some kind of ritual as a memorial or an aid memoir, if you like, in order to stir up the dragon consciousness, genetic memory and so on, all to the good. But if it's to practice magic, no, I'm not into that. Personally, what other people get up to, fine. But I don't promote that in the Dragon Court. If people join the Dragon Court, the best thing to do, I think, or if they want to, what I like to have from people is genealogy, genetic test results if they've got one, and we promote ftDNA on the net for that, and Cousin Freddy in the Balkans is the chief administrator for the Ashina Gene Project with them, so we'd like that, so genealogy and a nice photograph for the family album. Anyone at all is able to contact me. I don't give set lessons. I work through questions, and I work through advice, encouragement, teaching, without structure, because a lot of this stuff is to do with the eternal. And as soon as you start having a set of rules or regulations or whatever, which are language, which is very, very temporal, then without spontaneity and without encouraging meditation, all you're doing is following somebody else's path by rote, and you're taking on board what they say you should be doing and so on. We don't do that. What we like to do as a family is to simply encourage each other, not only to ask questions, but also to research and study for themselves, and to contribute that research to archives, to recommend others, and so on. Membership of the court is absolutely free of charge. Nobody is asked to bring their checkbook with them when they join. And the easiest way to join and get in with things is to contact me at my email address, which I think your listeners will be a lot it will be a lot easier for them to be able to mark it down if you told them what it was. My throat's getting a little bit hoarse and I'm 4,000 miles away. So if you'd like to give the my personal email address out at the end of the interview, then I will very happily welcome any inquiries, and I would very seriously recommend that people join up to the Dragon Sovereignty Facebook page. It's a lot of fun, and there are a lot of very, very wise, decent people there.
Well, I've certainly found that to be true myself, and well, thanks so much for being on, Nick. I've learned a lot, and I know that people in the audience have learned
a lot.
Can I
make a quick public announcement?
Yes, please.
Before you go. I've been having a thing with one of Freddie's Dragon Wards, Cousin Freddie's Dragon Wards, Julianne Sonada de Vere. She was adopted by Freddie, a dragon adoption, and we are betrothed, and hopefully, if I can con her silly, she'll eventually marry me, and I'm very, very happy. Just wanted to give her a quick mention. Hope that's okay.
Well, congratulations, Nick. So, a new dragoness will be coming into the fold.
Yep.
Excellent.
She's of the royal Ashkenazi descent, which, again, as you know, is one of the royal tribes of Israel. And that being the case, she'd probably have the same R1B genes as me. And if she is... Well, she's Grand Duchess of Khazaria under Freddie. And there's a likely chance that she will be able to trace herself back like Freddie can around about 40,000 years. So I'm dead pleased. Love her very much.
If you give out my
email address, cousin.
Yes, I'll do that.
I'll
answer
any inquiries.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much, Nick. And... of course, I'll be in touch.
One last thing. Cousin Nicky Kopacek from Italy. He and I are amalgamating together. He's the head of the House of Dracula Basarab, not only on Facebook, but in reality as well. He's Count of Saxenstein. We're exchanging formalities next week. And love and kisses to him too. And I'll speak to you later, Mark.
Okay, thank you again, Nick. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Mark. Brilliant.
Bye for now.
Bye now.
Nick's email address is drakenberg@talktalk.net. And Drakenberg is drakenberg@talktalk.net. So thank you all for being here today with us, and I'm going to be off the air probably next week and then back on the following week, and looking forward to being back here with you again with another exciting guest. And in the meantime, always remember that the Holy Grail is right inside of you. You don't have to look anyplace else but in your own heart. So go there and find it. Bye for now.